This podcast contains explicit material. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Joy of Text, a monthly podcast about Judaism and sexuality. On this episode, we answer a listener question about spotting.
It's like the first time in all of the laws of Nidah that you have the post-gimp saying, we asked women, what is this sensation they're experiencing?
So many women feel like they're cheating the system.
Then we hear from sex therapist and author Dr. Steven Snyder about his new book, Love Worth Making.
Most sex writing these days is about how to shake it up and make it more exciting. And I go, come on, that doesn't work.
And finally, the final word. This one comes from Tamima in Chicago.
Tamima, go you.
That's all coming up after this quick word from our sponsor.
Yeshivat Chovevei Torah is proud of its new class of 12 rabbis, which brings our total to 120 rabbis now serving Jewish communities. These modern Orthodox rabbis are making a difference in the United States, Europe, Australia, and Israel. If you think you have what it takes to be a Jewish leader and to be the next Chovevei Torah rabbi, come visit us and see what we're all about. For source sheets to accompany the Joy of Text episodes and for other great Torah, visit our Torah library at www.yctorah.org.
Welcome to The Joy of Text. I'm Rebecca Honig-Friedman, and I'm here with Dr. Batsheva Marcus, president of JOFA and clinical director at Maze Women's Health, and Rabbi Dov Linzer, Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Chovevei Torah Rabbinical School. Later on, we're going to be talking with Dr. Steven Snyder, the author of Love Worth Making, How to Have Ridiculously Great Sex in a Long-Lasting Relationship. But first, we're going to jump into our listener question about spotting. Hi, we're a couple living in Israel. We're big fans of the podcast. We've learned a lot from it. Thanks. So we have a question about blood spotting while on birth control pills. The general halachic advice about spotting is to wear colored panties, wear black panty liners, not look when you pee, not look when you shower, etc. That way you can stay tahora, pure, despite the spotting. But sometimes when I'm connecting packages of pills for 2 to 3 months, the spotting gets really bad. At this point, it's really obvious to me that I'm bleeding, but technically I haven't seen blood, so I'm tahora. If I were to wear black panty liners, I could probably have a full period without seeing blood and avoid going to the mikvah. Our question is, one, why does the don't look solution work? Aren't we just lying to ourselves when we don't look, but we know that we are spotting uterine blood from the pills? Two, does don't look work for heavy spotting? Is there some cutoff between light spotting and heavy spotting where not looking is no longer a good halachic solution?
So we've gotten a couple of questions like this, and I feel like this is an issue that's so not addressed in the general, out there in the world. So I'm so glad we're going to be addressing this issue because I think it has a significant impacts way beyond what people usually think.
Yeah. So here's the story. The Mishnah deals with cases about where a woman finds various spots on her clothes and so on. And
blood spots.
Okay. And it has a range of situations in which it's not a concern and it doesn't make her a nida. I'll get to some of the specifics. But in the mission, at least, the reason seems to be because there was a reasonable concern it didn't come from her body. And therefore, you walk through the marketplace and people are slaughtering chickens or whatever, and who knows, they were not so hygienic and so on. But in the Gemara, the Amora Shmuel, very early on, actually says something which changed all of the halachas about this, because if that's where we were, then anytime a woman would spot, it would be a problem when she had it on her underwear and she knew it came from her body. But he actually says that something—
Her body meaning her uterus.
Her vagina, right.
Okay.
So, and what he says is that even if it certainly comes from her uterus, from her vagina, even it is not considered blood that makes her a nida if it's not accompanied with what's called in the Gemara hargasha, a sensation. So there's a whole debate what this sensation means, exactly what type of a sensation. But what it seems like he's trying to do is to locate it as it's not just spotting, it's actually her period. And one of the things that defines it, or it's actually need of blood, and one of the things that defines that, some understand that that sensation might be the type of menstrual cramping that comes with bleeding. So that's that halacha changes everything, because what that halacha means is that when there isn't that sensation, even if it's definitely from her body, even if it's on her tight-fitting underwear, it came from the vagina, it's uterine blood, it it is not biblical nida because it did not come with this sensation. I actually have to say parenthetically that Charlotta von Roberts, who's a sort of feminist Talmudic scholar, she actually said that what this did, in addition to the halachic points, that it's the way it changed halacha, is it resituated nida back into the woman's subjective experience rather than just making it something objective that like the male rabbis could judge. It's the question, are you as a woman experiencing this? And actually, it's like the first time in all of the laws of Nida that you have, you know, the poskim already, the Beit Yosef saying, we asked women, what was this hargasha? What is this sensation they're experiencing? And they really don't know what we're talking about when we say they're supposed to be having the sensation. So you actually find, you know, them trying to understand what's being
referred to. Yeah. Yeah. And most women will say now that they don't have a hargasha.
Exactly.
They don't have the feeling other than severe dampness. They don't have a feeling of there's blood starting to come out, even though they might have cramps the day before or 2 days before, something like that.
Exactly. And that leads to, I would say, three different positions of how to deal with this that women report and have reported for hundreds of years that they don't have this sensation the Gemara is talking about. So some have argued a very extreme position, which is, okay, nobody nowadays is a real biblical nida. It's all rabbinic because they don't have this sensation. As you might imagine, most people don't take that approach.
Don't like that one.
Don't like that one. Some go to the opposite extreme and say, well, since no women have it, then everybody is a nida because it's no longer
any blood,
right.
Whether or not you have any kind of feeling or hargasha is still the blood
and
nida.
And people do not accept that either. Normally, we've settled on a middle position, which has been to say that when there is a heavy flow or when a woman does an internal check, you know, which is a bedika, which women do to check if they're getting their period or to check if their period has stopped, then that we sort of assume that there was this sensation. But when you find the blood on the underwear, even though you know it's from the body, if it did not come with the sensation, which it basically never does, then it's only in this rabbinic category. So that becomes very helpful because that allows us to say, outside of a real getting of your period or outside of these internal checks, it's all rabbinic. And because it's all rabbinic, it allows for leniencies, not just leniencies. I mean, obviously we keep the rabbinic laws as well, but the rabbis built in situations in which because it's rabbinic, we can make up the rules. You know, the rabbis made the rules and they said, it's not even a rabbinic problem under a certain number of circumstances.
And these are the circumstances.
Yeah. So the circumstances
you don't
are,
see the blood.
So
up for 1 second. Why is the halachic discourse so focused on this concept of the hargasha rather than all the other indications that
quantity.
A woman might be getting her period, like the time of the month or the number of days or quantity?
Yeah, those are, well, it's in practical halacha nowadays, quantity does factor in, but it's a complicated issue in that halacha to some degree tries to quantify in measurable terms what it means by like need a blood. And in other ways, it does not look at those biological realities. So it somehow sort of latched on to certain formal measures and not others to try to quantify this. So I don't have a full answer, but you are right. That is strange, right? Which is, I think what a lot of women bothers a lot of women. Like I know biologically what's happening to me and you're asking me to play by these like technical formal
arbitrary rules. Okay. So what happened was as a result of this was that because unless you're actually having your period, if you're just spotting in between, so for example, you're spotting on the pill or you're spotting, you know, when you're pregnant, for example, or for some other reason you may be spotting or you maybe get fibroids and you're spotting, then this became a practical issue because that's where the rabbis stepped in and said, okay, let's see if we can be protective of the couple sexual relationship by trying to make it easier not to have your period. And that's when these rules kind of developed. What are you laughing at?
I'm laughing at because like, I don't like sort of speculating as to the rabbi's motives. Okay. And I don't think they're coming and saying, let's save this couple sex life. I don't know exactly what was behind it, but
you
one way
think
or
it
another.
Was, let's allow them to have sex?
I don't know. It might have become as like, let's try to figure out whether this is need a blood or not. And let's come up with this definition, which is a helpful quantifiable
measure. No, I understand, but those would not
measure.
Be there for use colored underwear. You know what I'm saying? Like that
right,
the only
true.
Reason you could possibly say, don't look, use colored underwear, use panty liners,
okay.
Was because you want to not make the person go be a nida and you want to save the capacity to be able to have sex. I don't know if that means save their sex
so
life.
I certainly think that in sort of, current day rabbis, that is completely it. What exactly led to the original crystallization and formulation in the Gemara, I think might have had, I wouldn't assume it was that or only that. But yes, that certainly is how it plays out
nowadays.
So now
run through some of the typical, tricks that people use.
What are the things? So in the Gemara, there are actually three primary leniencies, or exceptions, I should say. And actually, the Gemara never sort of lists them all together, and some debate whether we say all three of them. But in the end, we say all three of them, and they are the following. One is if it's on a colored garment, even if you know that had it been on white, it definitely would have been red.
Right, like even if it's light blue.
If it's like light, even if it's, there's even questions if it's like tan, it doesn't matter. It's like a technical exemption. Again, when we're dealing with this spotting and not a real period, so it's a colored garment. It's a garment which, that's the panty liner and the colored underwear and so on. It's a garment that would not be susceptible for ritual impurity, for tumah. So I don't want to now teach, as I told my students, I said, like there's two places in all of practical halacha that you have to know laws of tumah and tahara, like which types of objects. One is for nida and the other is for what you can use for schach and your sukkah. So anyway, the simple point is, in order for something to be susceptible for becoming impure and hence a problem, you have to be dealing with a basic, if you're dealing with like a garment, it has to be made out of natural fibers and it has to be woven. So something like a pad that's basically just tufts of cotton pressed together, or toilet paper, which is also like paper pulp. It is not a natural fiber that is woven. Polyester might be woven, but it's not a natural fiber. So unless it is both a natural fiber and woven. Well, wood, what do you mean? Like if you actually saw it on a wooden chair?
I don't think you would, yes.
Okay, so if it's not clothing, then if it is something that is a wooden chair, that could be an issue. It would be susceptible.
Okay.
So if we're dealing with clothing or like toilet paper or pads or things like that, it's only if it's a combination of natural fibers that are woven.
Which why panty liners, for example.
Now the question becomes about a toilet seat. So if you find it on the toilet seat, well, that's made out of plastic. So even though that's not a clothing, even if it's something like a chair, a wooden chair would be a problem, but a plastic toilet seat is not a problem. There's a question about finding blood in the toilet water. So normally the rule is that things that are like food, edible, drinkable, are susceptible, but is toilet water really in that category? In general, these consensuses, toilet water is also not a problem. So if it's on the toilet seat, it's in the toilet water, it's on the toilet paper, it's on the polyester panties.
Okay, so far you covered colored. Natural,
right?
Natural type, woven,
right? Etc.
Okay.
And the third one is the size. Only if it's the size of, different opinions, but let's say between a penny and a nickel. Okay, if
it's smaller than that, the size
of the stain.
And is that cumulative or is that individual?
So the stain has to all be together and the red part has to be that big. If you've got a stain that's big, but the red part is not as, is only
a
small part of that. It's brown or whatever, and only the red part is smaller than that amount, it is not a problem. It has to be, and if it's two stains, it's not a problem. It has to be one stain, and the one stain, the red part of that stain is that big. So those are a lot of exceptions. Why? The reason for all of them, there are different speculations, different explanations given. I will tell you that I think the most insightful explanation, if you combine all three, and this is another point that Charlotta von Roberts makes, is that all these three are required for laws of tzara'at, like what we call sort of biblical leprosy. You know, if somebody has a spot on their garment and it's this, as the Torah describes, green, red, different colors or whatever, the garment becomes impure. And what she actually says, and I think there's a lot of truth to this, is that with the rabbis, when they were created, this is why I was laughing about, is it about trying to save the couple's sex life, is that often when the rabbis try to create systems, they look for pre-existing models. So if here we have a new system called stains, and stains make on garments, because often it will be on garments, makes the woman impure, and also the stains have to be inspected and determined, are they red, are they not red? Well, that's very much like the Torah's model of a stain on a garment that's leprosy, not a stain of blood, but this whatever, miraculous stain, and those are the three criteria. The garment has to be susceptible for impure, the stain has to be a certain size, and the garment can't be colored.
So in practice, what has happened is that, and I see this all the time when I have women who, let's say, go on IUD and they stain for a few months after that, because often when you get an IUD, you may stain for a few months before your periods get smaller and either stops, whatever, or post-pregnancy, or they're trying to get pregnant, or they've gotten on the pill. There are times in their life when they just are spotting and spotting and spotting. And if they stopped and sort of were considered nida every single time they started spotting, they would never be able to be in a situation where they could have sex.
Right.
And that it's extremely detrimental in relationships and to individuals. And so those are the situations where I've seen the rabbis kind of feels to me a little bit like they came trying to charge in on their white horses.
Absolutely.
And say, listen, it's okay. Use colored underwear, use black panty liners, don't look. And then, okay. So on the one hand, that's all lovely and good. And on the other hand, now you're going to hear me really rail, because I will tell you that so many women feel like they're cheating the system.
And that's what the listener basically is saying in their question.
Right. And I think that what is almost hard to understand, and I feel like the rabbis, this is one of the situations where the rabbis have never been in that position, mm-hmm. where you feel like you are a big faker. Mm-hmm. And it's not just your own soul that you're putting on the line here. You're putting your husband's soul on the line here as well. So the analogy I would give is, if I said to a man, listen, if your pee is a certain color when you pee it, it's going to make you not be able to have sex with your wife. You're going to have to separate for 12 days. So, but here's the deal. If you kind of don't look at the pee color, and if you don't look at the tissue that you're wiping, or you only use tissues and you throw the tissue away quickly, or if you pee into a pink toilet rather than a white toilet, then it won't count. And so you're going to go running up and down the steps to find the pink toilet. But if you do end up having that yellow thing and either seeing it, or it's more pink, or it's a little bit more yellow, the color of the pee, and you sleep with your wife, that's a really heinous problem, right? Think how that feels like. You feel like you're trapped in this like crazy world where am I not looking enough, or am I not looking too much? And am I crossing a line into like where I'm really, really, I kind of know it's my period, but it's not my period. And it is the most crazy making. And so I'll meet with women and they'll be trying to use these, you know, loopholes, and they're crying in frustration. They kind of don't know if they're using them right. It's like almost an untenable situation.
Yeah. Right. It's also just the hyper focus on these.
That's a whole nother issue.
Details of your body.
That's a whole nother issue. That's right. Like, exactly. Well. Totally crazy making. Like, oh my God, I have to go to the bathroom. I have to wipe. I have to not look. But I did look. But did I see? But did I not see? But is it a tissue or is it a handkerchief? You know. Yes. Yeah, so that's a whole nother piece. This is like my body, and I need to like worry about like, did I sneeze to the right? Did I sneeze to the left? Did the snot when I sneeze hit, two tefachim out or one tefachim? Like, and I feel like people are, you know, the general tendency is to say, oh my God, look how great the rabbis were. They were so lenient about all these things. They gave you all these great loopholes, and nobody is sensitive to the fact that these loopholes can be incredibly crazy.
Right. Also, I think just the term loophole, like it feels like you're getting away with something.
Well, I didn't use
not
the term
really,
loophole. But I guess leniency. Better than leniencies is the word like exemption or exception, an exception to the rule. I mean, actually, you know, this idea of the rabbis looking for leniencies already, or like looking to make life easier, is already in the Mishnah, that a woman comes to Rabbi Akiva and says, I saw blood. And he says to her, and this is actually a different type of a reason that it would not be a problem that I didn't mention, is if it could be attributed to something else, which comes up a lot in terms of, I had an IUD put in, I had this procedure, the bleeding is because of some other reason. So Rabbi Akiva said to the woman, and he said, is it possible that, you know, you or your husband or your son maybe had a cut and a scab and maybe it opened up? And she said, yeah, it's possible. So he said, okay, fine, you're okay. So then his students were looking at one another and saying, what? And he said, no, the rabbis only said this to be lenient. They're trying to find ways to be lenient. So that's actually in the Mishnah, which doesn't address your point that
right.
It's playing a game and you feel that you're cheating the system. So I totally. And
so either you feel like you're cheating the system, or you're not even sure whether you're cheating the system or not.
Because you don't know if you're doing
and
it right.
You can't discuss it. It's like if I put a spoon that was not Pesach dick in my chicken soup with my, you know, I can call up and have a conversation. Like, I know I use a spoon. Did I use it before? Did I use it after? But this is one of those situations where you really can't. Like, you know, you peed. Did you sort of see it on the tissue? Did you not see it on the tissue? Did you see it on the water? Did you see it? Like,
I don't have a good answer to it. But the one thing I will suggest is that would it be better if people were clearer and sort of the way I explained it and said, listen, All of this stuff, when it's not really your period, and when you're not real, like if you're really getting your period, of course, that's a problem. And we'll talk about how we know that in a minute. Or if you did an internal check, don't do an internal check if you don't have to. That's an issue. But everything else, this is all rabbinic. So don't worry. It's like, you know, would that make you feel
better?
So you're saying
that
don't worry, it's not a problem, but don't worry. That's why there are all these special rules.
But are you saying if I know it's not my period, don't worry about it? You can just assume it's
right. So what does that mean? When is it your period that these rules don't apply?
So let's say she got an IUD put in. Right. And now she's just spotting all the time, massive quantity, not massive, but lots of, again, right, like lots of blood.
Right.
On the tissues, on the, you know, right, on the red
right,
underwear.
So the basic rule is,
on the black
is that, yes, these rules, these exceptions, that she can ignore them. So the question is, okay, so what does it mean when I'm getting my period and I can't use these rules? I can't use, because that was actually the questioner said, like how heavy of a flow and so on. So here there are, like different rabbis go by different standards. The standard that I have a tradition, sort of, I've received, is that it goes by like seven times the amount that I said before. The amount I said before was like the size of a penny or a nickel. So only once the blood is like seven times that amount do we consider it to be a quantity that we're going to assume is a period. And then it doesn't matter. We don't ask what time of the month and so on. I mean, if it's clearly due to like some vaginal scraping or something, it's not uterine bleeding, or that's a different story. But if it is coming from the uterus, then once it's that quantity, and less than that quantity, it just goes by these rules. If you're not doing an
internal check. So that's actually helpful. I mean, I think this becomes an issue largely also when women are perimenopausal, menopausal, right? Because then your period is no longer regular, right? So not that everybody always has a regular period, but a lot of people have regular periods. But then when you're heading into menopause or perimenopause, your period can be every 7 days, every 21 days, every 3 months. Like it does become much less likely to be able to tell. And I guess my message really would be through all this would be like, have more sympathy for the rabbinic authorities in our life, to have more sympathy that, you know, it's all fine and good to say, well, don't look and use all these leniencies, but be aware how crazy making that
can
be.
I know, and I wish I knew the answer, because obviously, you know, we want these exceptions.
Right,
we want these.
I'm just saying
leniencies.
The answer is just to be sympathetic, to understand how crazy making they can be. I mean, I think that's in and of itself an important thing.
And I want to go back and answer the one halachic point we didn't touch on, which is what happens, maybe this is partly when one's perimenopausal, but also nowadays a lot of birth control pills lead to very, very light periods, like very light spotting.
Right, or the Mirena IUD.
Right. So this becomes really interesting. Here's where the rabbis start worrying about the biology. Like they say, okay, if we know that this is the period, because like she was been on the placebo, or it's the whatever, it's the time of the month, but because of the hormones, it's very light. So technically she's not Anita. So there have been some rabbis that say, oh, come on, but if we know it's a period, she's Anita. Like here's where they're responding to the biology. But many, many rabbis nowadays will say, look, we go by the rules. And if a woman, because she's on this IUD or because she's on a pill, and all she gets every month is light spotting, and it's, you know, and you're going by these things in terms of the size, it always has to be red. If it's not red, you know, it's not an issue. Then the question is it red? And, you know, going to a rabbi or a yoetzet halacha or a maharad. But some will say, you know, it doesn't matter if it's, as long as it's following these rules. Yes, it could be that you won't be Anita.
Once we're discussing color, can you explain something to me? So blood, when it sits, gets blacker.
Right.
So
black is one of the colors, because of that reason.
Like something that looks like dried blood, basically,
yes,
would be.
Yeah.
Right. So where do we find black panty liners?
Okay, so the black panty liners is a very funny question, because I was sitting in the office once. This is like, I don't know, a couple of years ago. And I was talking to a woman that using black panty liners, and she was like, I don't know where to find black panty liners. So after that, I Googled black panty liners, and I could order them on Amazon. So I ordered a bunch of boxes to keep in my office, and I'm looking at these boxes of panty liners, and I just burst out laughing, because they look like regular, normal panty liners that you'd buy like in the supermarket. But then on the side in Hebrew was written, you have to check with your local rabbi to see about the use of these panty liners. So clearly they were made for the Orthodox market. It was hysterical.
I do want to say, first of all, I have two questions. Panty liners are what? Are they like pressed cotton? What are they made out of?
They're usually synthetic.
So it's interesting that you need black panty liners because they would not.
But I think that goes back to the heart of the question, which is it's much less upsetting to a woman if she uses a panty liner and actually doesn't see the blood than if you tell her use a white panty liner and then you see the blood on it. Maybe some panty liners are cotton. I don't think most of them are because they'd be so expensive.
But even if they're cotton, they'd be pressed. They wouldn't be woven, right?
Because I think just the idea of the quality of the fabric being a factor in this feels so strange that it's still the same thing coming out of your body, and shouldn't that be what it's about?
Right.
So what's really interesting now
is they are now making underwear, dark black underwear that is made specifically to catch the menstrual blood,
right?
To not smell.
What's it called? Sphinx or something.
Yeah. So that would be a really interesting question because then you would really not have a sense of what was going on. Yeah. Anyway, okay. I don't want to beat a dead horse.
I think we've talked enough about blood spotting for the moment. So, by the way, Thinx is the name of the underwear for periods.
Yes. Okay.
If they're interested in sponsoring, we have to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Steven Snyder on Love Worth Making.
At Mays Health, we know that if you're having sexual problems, it can have significant impact on your life and on your relationship. We also know that these problems are not all in your head, and it's important for you to know that pain, low libido, erection, or orgasm problems can all be successfully resolved. Mays is the only treatment center of its kind in the area, addressing both the physical and emotional sources of sexual difficulties. If you're a man or a woman experiencing sexual problems, please don't go another day feeling like there is no solution. Visit us at www.mayshealth.com.
We're back with our special guest, Dr. Steven Snyder, who is a sex therapist and psychiatrist. He's been practicing for over 30 years and has been named a New York Magazine best doctor every year since 2012. And he's also the author.
What happened before 2012?
Seriously.
Yeah, but before 2012, we don't count before 2012.
Right. Okay, gosh. Okay.
And he is also the author of the new book, Love Worth Making: How to Have Ridiculously Great Sex in a Long-Lasting Relationship. I know we're all excited to hear about that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So how did you get into this line of work?
I went to medical school. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do with myself. Became a psychiatrist, and that was okay. And then somebody said there's something called sex therapy, and I said, oh, I'm so there. It just sounded like such a happy thing. And it has been. Sex therapists tend to be pretty happy people.
Really?
Yeah, Bill Esposheva, she'll tell you.
Wait a minute. You think sex... You thought of sex therapy as being a happy thing?
Oh my God, yeah. Compared to like treating bipolar and schizophrenia, yeah. One of the things that I say in the book is sex involves a regression to a more infantile state of mind. Mm-hmm. That's what makes it so delightful. It's the only time as adults that we get to rock and be held and fussed over and treated like the most important person in the world. And if you're not getting into a happy thing, it's not working. Mm-hmm. So the whole purpose of sex is to be happy.
You use the word happy a lot, but most people would associate the word pleasure with sex.
Yeah, I don't like the word pleasure because I think it gets overdone. You see a lot of sex books talking about pleasure this, pleasure that, especially like give your partner pleasure, pleasure your partner. And I think it's completely misguided because the fundamental satisfactions of sex are not necessarily the pleasurable ones. They're the narcissistic ones. They're this sense of being reflected in the other person's eyes, being seen as the most significant person in the world to that other person at that moment, and really being enjoyed in a total and present moment way that we don't get to enjoy once we get out of childhood unless we're having sex.
I have to process all of that.
Clearly you read the book.
No, clearly I have not yet read the book, but I have.
Well, I did read some of the book. Yeah. And as you were just saying, you take the focus away from pleasure. You call orgasm dessert.
Exactly. And this is, you know,
which totally fits, because if you remember an earlier episode we had, there she talked about orgasm as a chocolate chip cookie. So,
exactly. So the thing I say in the book is that one definition of a sex therapist, which I particularly like, is a person who doesn't really care that much about orgasms. Because as sex therapists, Batsheva will vouch for me, everybody else is so preoccupied with orgasms, and the sexual mind, or as I call it in the book, the sexual self, doesn't like goals. If you give it a goal, it's infantile. It'll just rebel against you. So any kind of a goal that you attach to sex, have an orgasm, have a baby, anything that you attach as a goal is going to cause trouble.
What made you decide to write the book?
Because I couldn't find it anywhere. I couldn't find a book to give my patients that was a detailed and instructive enough account of sexual feelings. There was a lot of books about sexual science. There was a lot of books about novelty, especially these days, techniques, that kind of thing. And there was nothing about feelings. It was this gaping gap. And so I decided I had to fill the gap.
What are some of the key advice or points you would make about how to get in touch with those positive feelings and not to be goal-oriented?
Well, the first is that sex is not about giving pleasure. It's about taking pleasure. For instance, there was a discussion at one point on this podcast about oral sex. And over it was said performing oral sex, giving oral sex. No, no, no. It's not about giving oral sex. It's about taking oral sex. If it's about giving, you shouldn't do it. You shouldn't do it unless it's delighting you and getting you excited.
Wait, I'm very confused because isn't sometimes the problem with sex that people are when the participants are in it for their own pleasure and not attending to the other person's needs and pleasure? And don't a lot of people get enormous amount of pleasure by being able to bring their partner to orgasm, by giving pleasure to their partner?
It's not what I see in the office. That may have been the problem in sex therapist's office 50 years ago, but it's not what I see these days. What I see is people, especially men, having been taught you got to take care of women's pleasure, you got to stroke them this way and stroke them that way. And the guy comes into my office and he says, I don't know what to do. My wife is so picky. Everything I do, she says, no, harder, softer, more like this, less of that, more like this. And I say, well, let me talk to your wife. And I say to the wife, he says, you're picky. He goes, oh, no, I'm not picky at all. It's just that he's just fumbling around down there. I want him to show me some passion. So the thing that's missing is passion. So maybe 50 years ago, you had guys who were oblivious to women's pleasure. And I'm sure those guys are still out there, but it's not the big problem we see in sex therapy these days. The big problem we see is that everybody's just trying to do it right, trying to follow the instructions on the book, give lots of pleasure to your partner, and you're getting very, very boring sex. They're boring their partners to tears.
You live within the Orthodox community.
Exactly, yeah.
So was being a observant Jew ever an obstacle for you in this?
Great question. I started out as a Reform Jew. I was a sex therapist before I became religious.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. I've known Steven Snyder for many, very long time. I did not know that.
Yeah, I became religious at the age of 40, which I was told is the letter Mem, which is transformations and transitions. And so I thought, okay, I got an opportunity here. And so I learned most of what I know about the religion. And one of the things that appealed to me the most about the religion, as I began to learn about it, this is 21 years ago now, was the sanctification of the ordinary. And I thought to myself, now that's a value, that's an important Jewish value, that's of tremendous value with sex. And it's one that's really, I talk about a lot in the book, especially the book is kind of a contrarian book. It goes against almost everything that's been talked about in sex books these days. Most sex books these days are about pleasure. And I say, no, it's not about pleasure. It's about a regression to a childlike state of mind that makes you feel special and you lose IQ points and all that good stuff. And most sex writing these days is about cultivating intensity, cultivating experience of otherness and finding adventure and novelty, whether it's a new sexy date or destination or situation and how to shake it up and make it more exciting. And I go, come on, that doesn't work. That never works. If you go chasing excitement, you're going to be in a hopeless quest. Instead, the key is the sanctification of the ordinary, which is a very Jewish value, that you're taking the experience and you're looking inward, being in the moment, and taking care of whatever you need in order to get to that state of mind where you're just a little bit hypnotized and lost in the experience and in the moment. And that's why I say it's not really about pleasure. It's about more the feeling experience.
So what do you think about having regular sex, even if you're not transported, because we go to the synagogue on a regular basis because every now and then we get transported?
Exactly. And I think sex is exactly the same way. because a lot of people say, okay, how can I make it hotter? How can I make sex hotter? It's a wrong approach. Sex is as hot as it's going to be at that moment with your partner, and you experience it for whatever it is. You stay there, and inspiration comes when it comes. You know, Picasso said, when inspiration comes, it finds me working. I say, when inspiration comes, it finds you having sex. And it goes completely against what you read in almost all sex books these days, which says the way to stay sexually satisfied in a long-term relationship is to cultivate novelty and adventure. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I don't think it's the heart of it. I think the heart of it is a more internal process, and the internal process is taking responsibility for your own sense of inspiration. I think it's fundamentally selfish. So that's why I hammer so much in the book on selfishness, that if a man has oral sex with his wife, it's extremely important that it be because it delights him.
But so let me push back a little bit at that. Yeah. Supposing she really loves having oral sex and he can take it or leave it.
Exactly. So I would say they shouldn't do it so much. What they should do is they should have a discussion about what are the particulars? What does she like about it? If it's not his favorite thing, to find something that really authentically he can get involved with, so it's not just a gift. I think he should be getting something. He should be taking something. He's got to take something away for the long term.
I'm sorry. I'm not buying this.
Go for it. Go for it. I'm happy to fight with you.
I think that you have to look at the macro, right? So sometimes I'll go with my wife to a movie that I really don't like going to, because the next time she's going to go with me to an action movie. So I'll go with her to the rom-com. And in the big picture, if we just went to movies, maybe we both really enjoyed, we would see two movies a year. So,
I keep trying to convince them that we should go to the movies together.
At the end of the day, there might not be anything that gives her the same pleasure as, let's say, oral sex. And what's it going to mean if he has to be always happy in the moment? Okay. If it's a red line and it's repulsive, that's a different issue. But if it's a question of druthers, we do things for our partners.
And I guess I feel profoundly different about that, not only in bed, but out of bed. I feel like it's not just a matter of a movie, because that's not going to be a regular occurrence in your life. If there's something that's going to be a regular occurrence in your life, you have to each stand up for what you really like. And if it doesn't really work, you have to figure it out. You have to create something that may not have been exactly what either of you had in mind, but works for the two of you. And at that point, you really become a couple.
So let me just kind of recast it, because I think what you're saying is it's one thing to do things for the other person. I cannot imagine you'd say you never should do anything for the other, just for the other person's pleasure. I'm sorry, I'm using that word pleasure. But yeah. I would think what you probably mean
there's
is—
there's no passion in it.
See, is that there are times that you do things for the other person's pleasure, but that ultimately you have to find something that allows you to regress and allows you to feel that kind of level of
passion.
Passion, you don't use the word pleasure, yeah. And that will be more sustainable.
Absolutely.
I think that if I can kind of sum up, you're trying to take the focus away from the physical aspect of sex and make it more about the emotional.
In general, I am in the book. The book does a lot of opposite things. It talks about how you don't really need desire in a relationship. It talks about how you really don't need orgasms. One of the most radical things I do is to say you don't really need sex. What you need is experiences of authentic arousal with your partner. Say you're in the kitchen. One of you has to go to work in a couple of minutes, holding each other, getting aroused together, and then saying, okay, I got to go. Arousal simply for its own sake, with absolutely no goal in mind. And very often couples describe that's the thing. Those moments are what really, really make them feel most authentic passion in a relationship. It's not necessarily when they have sex. So the guidelines in the book are for how to do that. It's really a how-to-do book, which says you can do it. You can do it in a long-term relationship. You got to relax about it. Don't worry about it. You're not going to feel passion all the time. But when you feel it and you feel that inspiration, you need to express it regardless of even whether you're going to have sex or not.
Right. You use the term simmering in your book. And I thought that was a really great. I love that. I love that description. That description of being able to revel in the erotic, even if it wasn't going to necessarily lead to sex immediately.
Even if it's a minute or two.
Right. So I thought that was great.
This is really fun.
Yeah. I really have to read the book now.
Well, I'm really glad to have been able to have this dust up with Rabbi Linzer, and look forward to his reading the book.
And the book again is Love Worth Making.
Love Worth Making, How to Have Ridiculously Great Sex in a Long-Lasting Relationship, and it's available at loveworthmaking.com.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for
being here. You're welcome. It's fun.
Next up, the final word, after this quick word from our sponsor.
What was the last Shabbat table conversation that got you excited? Who was the last person to change your mind? When was the last time a Facebook post just didn't feel like the right medium for expressing your thoughts and feelings? If you have answers to these questions, and I know you do, then it's time to write for Jofa's blog at The Jewish Week. At Jofa's blog, we believe in catalyzing change in the Jewish community by giving voice to its members and inspiring conversations one blog post at a time. Bring your voice into the collective conversation and submit your piece today. For more information, email shira@jofa.org.
And now it's time for our final word. This one comes from Tamima in Chicago, who actually started a sort of like a book club with The Joy of Text, where she got a bunch of friends together to listen to an episode. And she's calling it a sex sicha, which I love.
I love that. Tamima, go you. Okay.
So she just wrote in a little bit about that experience. She says, our group was looking for an opportunity to discuss topics that deeply interest each of us on a personal level without being too dry or text heavy. We enjoyed using the Joy of Text podcast as the basis of an important and fun conversation about sex and marriage, and were enlightened by the information gleaned from and perspectives shared by the moderators, panelists, and each other.
And if you're thinking of doing the same thing, you should just know that Dove always puts up a source sheet. So if you want to get together and talk about an episode and use the sources, have a little extra learning going on, that would be a great idea as well.
Which they did.
Oh, actually, they used the sources? Yeah. Oh, that's great.
So yeah, I just thought that was a really cool idea. And if anyone also has any questions about doing something like that, they should feel free to email us.
Yeah.
joyoftextpodcast@gmail.com.
The sources are quite extensive with annotation, so you can really get much deeper into these topics.
Yeah, and those can all be found on tjot.org or thejoyoftext.org.
And on Yeshiva Chovei Torah website.
Correct. Yes.
There you go.
All right. Well, that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for a really wonderful discussion. Thanks so much for listening, and we hope you come back next time. Thank you to our guest, Dr. Stephen Snyder. This episode of The Joy of Text was recorded by Mike Hurst and produced and edited by me, Rebecca Honig-Friedman. If you have questions or comments you'd like to share with us, you can do so anonymously at www.thejoyoftext.org or send us a regular email at joyoftextpodcast@gmail.com. The Joy of Text is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, or any podcast app. If you like what you hear, show your support by giving us a 5-star rating and stay up to date with our latest episodes and live events by following us on Facebook or Twitter.